From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. A few weeks back, we talked with Bitter Southerner contributor Laura Relier, who told us about trying to lose her Southern accent when she moved to Chicago as a kid and then reclaiming it as an adult. We heard from a lot of you about your relationship to Southern accents and the experience of being thought of as a hick. This was a stereotype made popular by shows like the Beverly Hillbillies.
This here is the Clampett place. I'm Jed Clampett, my young and Ellie Mae, and Granny. Granny says you've been doing some wildcatting.
There's no need to. Mr. Clampett, that swamp of yours is full of oil.
I could have told you that.
Well, my company would like to pump it out.
Yeah, I'd like that too, but I just can't afford to have it done.
So today we are digging further into the persistent myth of the dumb Southerner with Marie Cochran. She's director of the Afrolatcha Artist Project, wrote about growing up African-American in Appalachia for Rewired.news, and she's joining me on the line. Marie, welcome.
Glad to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to have you with us. Also with us, Chuck Reese, host of the Bitter Southerner podcast on GPB, editor of the Bitter Southerner magazine. Chuck, great to have you back with us.
Always glad to be here.
So, Chuck, for you, the Beverly Hillbillies broadcast image of dim-witted white Southerners, 1962-71, dated, certainly, but why so indelible?
Well, for me, it's hard not to think of it as indelible because I grew up with it. I was born in 1961, and it's one of the earliest television shows I remember watching. But, you know, I didn't really know too many people like Jed and Granny, you know, and even though I grew up in a small rural town, if anything, we had a little more in common with the Mayberry of the Andy Griffith Show, which is, you know, arguably the pioneering show of you know, what I refer to now as hillbilly TV. But, you know, that is a trope about the South that has never gone away since the advent of television. I mean, it comes all the way up through things like Duck Dynasty.
Right, and Dukes of Hazzard, Hee-Haw, all that kind of thing. How about for you, Marie? Did you ever see families that looked or acted like yours in media growing up?
Well, first of all, I have to say that you paired us perfectly because I was born in 1962.
Perfect.
All right.
In Toccoa, Georgia. And so these are parts of my childhood. And, you know, the first paragraph that I put in my essay was that I simultaneously had a crush on John Boy of the Waltons and Michael of Good Time.
There you
so
go.
The thing was, I had pretty much to see reflections of myself in those two different shows that didn't adequately reflect what my experience was. But just piggybacking on what Chuck said, also, my favorite shows for entertainment were Soul Train and Hee Haw.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
At the same time.
Well, and Marie, you also write in your piece about what happens when you introduce yourself as a person from Appalachia. So what kind of responses do you get?
All right, here we go. If they're white folks, even some people who don't know me, who meet me, they'll ask me where I'm from. And then they'll ask me, okay, but how long have you lived here? And I said, I was born and raised in Stevens County. Then if they're black friends of mine from wherever, but specifically, let's say, Atlanta, they'll say, oh, you're the only family there.
Mm.
And that's how it was when I grew up. And unfortunately, that's still the way it is now.
Well, Chuck, this is something that you also came up against when you were working in a magazine in New York City. You know, how do people respond when they heard your accent from the South? Not that we're going to get to the race thing in just a second.
Well, when I first moved to New York City to go to work for Adweek magazine in 1984, you know, anytime anyone heard me talk, I mean, you can't go to New York with a twang like mine and not be made fun of, you know. I did find it interesting after a while because, you know, I was up there the first time I lived there for 5 years, and you learn how to adapt. But I adapted while keeping my accent because I just couldn't get rid of it. I mean, you know, the only place I would ever try is when I was ordering a bagel or a sandwich at a deli because it seemed to help if I tried to talk a little faster, you know, plain bagel, toasted, schmear.
Can I
I'm not convinced. Yeah, please do.
Yeah, because I'm glad that you talked about the whole idea of leaving our home, our rural communities, to go to urban communities, because even as you were asking me about, you know, how people reacted to finding out that I was from, you know, the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains, they didn't believe me because I don't have the twang.
Hmm.
And so it's not even about just the issue of race. I mean, I didn't try to get rid of it. I listen to a lot of public television, and I blame Mr. Rogers. And I wish I had the twang. So, you know, this whole, you know, sort of interweaving between expectations and reality, I think, is really what Chuck and I, you know, are dealing with in the work that we do.
Yeah, so, but you write, Marie, I'm a Black Southerner, and my experience, while it defies the white hillbilly stereotype, is assuredly Appalachian. Do you think Appalachian reads white?
Always.
Yeah,
but
you
not,
do?
Not always forever because of the word Afrolatcha. When Frank X. Walker and the group of Kentucky writers have not only, you know, put it in the dictionary and won various awards and created these incredible careers, but when I met Frank X. Walker 8 years ago in Asheville, North Carolina, I asked him, I said, you know, what's going on? At the time, they were, you know, blowing up. The Carolina Chocolate Drops had, you know, were performing. They hadn't won the Grammy yet. I met them before, you know, they became famous.
You knew them when.
I knew him when. But the thing was, you know, I asked him about visual art, and he said, do something with visual art. And that's why I created this network of creatives. But the thing is, you know, all of that is changing with this new generation of professionals and, you know, activists and, you know, people who really just know what their lived experience is. Because I didn't, you know, even say this, but, you know, I would assume, and this is something I'm going to explore, that my white friends, you know, were watching Soul Train too, and mm-hmm. because they sure were listening to Bill Rice, Mr. Rice, the Rice Man, play his soul, you know, radio show on Saturdays on WNEG. So people don't acknowledge the back and forth. They acknowledge that the banjo has African roots, but they don't talk about these lived experiences that we have.
Well, as director of the Afrolatcha Artist Project, you connect, support artists of color to keep the history of this region alive. You mentioned the band, the Carolina Chocolate Drops. So here's just a little bit of their song, Cornbread and Butter Beans.
Cornbread and butter beans, and you across the table, eating them beans and making love.
So, Marie, what do you think the history of Black Appalachian artists and residents not generally part of the story told about the region?
It doesn't fit a commercial perspective. And I think Chuck, again, could, you know, echo this. We have edited out the good stuff. And, you know, we really have to talk because it is complicated. It's layered and sometimes it's, you know, contradicts itself. Dixie, as a song, was written by Black people. Now, we won't even get into that, but I'm just dropping it in so your readers and listeners can go back and look it up. But when the Carolina Chocolate Drops performed on stage, they would do these little interludes and give out that information because not everybody goes to college and gets a PhD in anthropology or cultural studies. And we need to get the word out.
That's absolutely right, you know, because there's, if you look back into the history of Appalachia, even though there was the de facto racial segregation, there was also de facto racial integration in places too.
Right.
And you hear it most in the music. And when you dig back into the history of that Appalachian string band music, what you realize is that it was something that was created by Scots-Irish immigrants and by African-American people.
Poor people.
Poor people. It's poor people's music. And, you know, even though you might be a white kid who grows up in Appalachia listening to bluegrass music and you think that the banjo is a bluegrass instrument, it's the white man's instrument, but it's not. And once you learn that, you start making connections that you didn't. And that's, you know, I think that's the thing that is true no matter what part of the South's troublesome history you look at. You find, when you really dig in, you find more places where we were together across the racial barriers than you were probably aware of before. And to go back to your point, Marie, yeah, those were my two entertainment shows, Hee-Haw and Soul Train. And that's why to this day, I still have a stack of Stylistics, Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, and OJ's 45s on my shelf.
Uh-huh. And I love Dolly Parton, and I love Buck Owens, and, you know, as much. I mean, and, you know, we're putting a lot of information out there, and I hope, you know, I'm just loving the conversation. But when I moved to North Carolina, because I had these feelings that something wasn't really being explained well. I mean, I always thought, okay, my Atlanta friends, you know, aren't quite getting me. You know, my other friends might think that, okay, where we're from is backward, and isn't it grand that I'm a UGA grad and I went to the School of the Art Institute in Chicago, and, you know, I've left these humble beginnings, but it's my home. But when I went and got a job in North Carolina, I met Jeff Biggers, and I'm looking at his book right now, The United States of Appalachia, because that's really what I riffed off of when I wrote the essay. And it says how Southern mountaineers brought independence, culture, and enlightenment to America. And when I read this book that told me that Nina Simone, Bill Withers, et cetera, were from my region, and then later met Frank X. Walker, it all came together for me. It really did.
I want to just pick up and tell listeners we're listening to Marie Cochran. She's from the Afrolatia Artist Project. Chuck Reese is also with us from the Bitter Southerner. Terrific comment here on, let's see, our Facebook page or on Twitter. Leonard Henry says, for dumb Southerners, we certainly lead the rest of the country in the number of excellent writers we produce. We also lead the country in Medal of Honor recipients. My wife was placed in a remedial class in New York City as a child because she was stereotyped for her Southern accent. But what they didn't appreciate, being rather narrow-minded, was that she was the granddaughter of one of America's most famous poets and a genius. So we're talking about the artistic tradition. You were talking about music just then, but also literary tradition. So I'm just wondering, you know, for you, Chuck, you're an editor of the Bitter Southerner magazine, so you're trying to expand the definition of how people think about the South. But at the same time, you know, how do you make distinctions? You know, if somebody comes to you and says, like, I don't know, something prototypically old Southern seeming, about whether you propagate that or you give it attention, or you're just saying, like, this is part of it all. I'm not quite sure what that question is, but I wonder if you can pick up on it.
I think so. You know, I think the thing that, well, the thing that I have definitely found over the 5.5 years we've been publishing this thing is that people, there's this phenomenon that's happening all across the South and has been happening for a good many years now, which is that our region is full of people in cities who live city kinds of lives. You know, Atlanta in many ways is indistinguishable from anywhere else that has hipster coffee shops.
Big metropolitan area, yeah.
These cities are populated by so many of us who grew up with distinctly rural roots.
Right.
We may not have done the thing that so many Southerners have done and left the region for good, but, you know, if we're still here, we come to the city and our minds expand and we start looking at the world in different ways. And, you know, if somebody comes up to me with some old South stuff today, I kind of just write it all off.
Mm-hmm.
Because so much of it is based on things that we were taught in the public schools. You know, I mean, there's no doubt that the original sin of the South was slavery, right? Another second wave original sin was we spent 100 years teaching our children that we did not fight a war over slavery.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Which was a lie. I mean, we were literally all taught, you know, I hear countless stories. I've heard them ever since we started, of people, you know, saying that when they chose slavery on a high school quiz as the cause of the Civil War, they got an X on mm-hmm. their answer, mm-hmm. you know, and that's just the truth. And, you know, the thing that, that really brought that home to me in a big way was an essay that Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote immediately after the shootings at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston a few years ago. And in that piece, he quoted from several of the Confederate States secession declarations, including Georgia's. You don't have to read more than a paragraph into any of those things to find out that the war was really fought over the ability of the states to hold slaves. And no one had ever put that document in front of me in any public school class or in any history class at the University of Georgia. I read it for the first time when I was 54.
And I want to add something to what Chuck just said.
Yeah, and Marie, we'll have to wrap soon, so if you can pull it to a close.
I'll make that real quick. I just got back from the Appalachian Studies Association conference in Asheville, and they showed the new documentary called Hillbilly. Everybody in that room cried, including me.
Why?
Because it hit home in so many ways. As we said earlier, these acts that have happened through public education or, you know, elected officials meant to divide poor people. Because ultimately, when these poor people come together, they make music, they make babies, they make community. You know, all of these things happen. And, you know, we could go into all kinds of theories about, you know, the whys of that, but we need to really come together because we have so much in common, and that's the richness of the South.
You know what? I'm going to vote that we extend this conversation on another day. I would love to pick it back up. We've got so much more to talk about, but Marie Cochran
nice
and Chuck
meet
Reese.
You, Chuck.
Thank you, Marie. Great. I'll send you a hillbilly T-shirt.
All righty.
That's it for today. Have a great weekend. This is On Second Thought.